Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mulch. This is another Bircher podcast. What we do is conference calls with members of the John Birch Society. And then we have conversations with JBS leaders and other patriotic leaders and get more insight on how we can win this battle for freedom in our constitutional republic. I've got with me Mitchell Shaw. He's a very well-spoken tech expert. We've both recently just read the book that Edward Snowden recently wrote, and so we've had a good discussion about that book. And my interest right now is what is technology doing to our kids? What should we as parents and grandparents be talking about? And you know, what should we be doing to protect our kids from what big tech is trying to do and what the Council on Foreign Relations is trying to do to get kids to be less, I don't know if there's a better, if there's a way I should put this, Mitch. The CFR is basically trying to make our kids into government minions, where they work and they're not necessarily good people, but they're good workers. But anyways, Mitch, welcome to the Bircher podcast and thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Well, I recently read your article titled "Freeing the Web from Big Tech," and for those of you that are watching this on video, I'll hold up the magazine. It's from this is the New American Magazine. All John Birch Society members get this twice a month, and even if you're not a John Birch Society member, you can still get it. But this was the cover article, and I'm going to share the internet link to you to those that are watching this on the on my YouTube channel. But anyways, Mitchell. Talk about this article and how do we free ourselves from big tech, and then how do we free our kids from big tech?
Okay, so you know, the major thing that has to be remembered when we're talking about any of this across the board is that big tech is largely synonymous with liberal. Though my concerns would change very, very little if big tech were synonymous with conservative, because the issue really is a handful of companies that control all of the platforms that we use to live our digital lives, right? So if we are sending emails or, you know, we're doing this conversation over the internet, your internet service provider is involved in the equation. My internet service provider is involved in the equation. All of the other people who are logged in, their internet service providers are logged into the are part of the equation. And then we add to that the platform that we're using to do this, any other softwares that you have open on your computer, any other softwares anybody else has open on their computers that are part of this conversation right now, all of that is part of the equation. And they are all able to, to one degree or another, to harvest data about us. So to get ready for this, of course, I've opened several articles on my laptop so that I've got those ready to reference as we're talking about, including the article we're talking about, Freeing the Web from Big Tech. So if I were running an operating system that allowed that type of intrusion, say I was just doing this on Mac or Windows, I run Linux for everything, but if I were doing this on Mac or Windows, and I were allowing things like tracking cookies and super cookies and tracking pixels that Google does, that Facebook does, that can track me across the web, then everything I've got, every page I've got open, every article, every application that I've got open would be clear to be seen by anyone intercepting this. And when I say anyone, I don't mean some hacker in his pajamas eating cold pizza in his grandmother's basement. I mean Google, I mean the NSA, I mean the FBI, I mean Facebook, I mean any of the big tech or surveillance state players that would be part of this. And so part of freeing the web from big tech, as the article points out, are these smaller players that are coming on board. And when I say smaller players, I don't mean unknowns. I mean people like Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who literally invented the web. I don't know how much your listeners know about the difference. But, you know, so when people say the web or the internet, people think those are synonymous. They're not really at all. The internet is a hardware component. It is all of the computers, servers, what have you, that make up the internet. So that is a network, an internetwork of networks. the web is a software component that is built on top of that. So you use the internet to get to a website. That website is a software component. It doesn't physically exist. It's just code. So there is a difference between the web and the internet. And while Berners-Lee did not invent the internet, he did invent the World Wide Web. And he is one of the big players now talking about ways to decentralize the web through a series of decentralized applications and services that would allow people much more freedom to hang on to their data locally and decide which pieces of that data they share out onto the web so that things that they find appealing are available to them. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Okay, so one thing that I think you and I discussed making sure that we covered in our segment today was Google, right? Because, you know, when we look at Google, I think the first thing that has to be said up front, Google is not a search engine. Google is not a series of services, YouTube, Android, what have you. Google is a data mining and data analysis company masquerading as those things. Google offers pretty much everything it does for free, including its Google Apps for Education suite that it makes available to schools at little or no cost. And when I say little or no, I mean the little part of that is no obvious cost. I mean, there might be a small upfront cost that's more than covered in other components. So at the end of the day, any school in America can choose to hand out Chromebooks to their students with the full GAFE suite, and it will cost that school $0 to do that, okay? So why would Google do that? If they're giving you something for nothing, how are they paying for it? And what's in it for them? Cui bono. Well, the cui bono is your kids' data, your data. Because it's not just data when they're in the classroom, it's data when they're at home at, you know, 11 o'clock at night wrapping up that homework assignment and they decide to pop over and watch a YouTube video or visit Facebook or whatever else they're doing on that Chromebook. Because anything that they're doing on that Chromebook is being harvested by Google, despite promises on Google's part not to do that. So I actually wrote about this back in 2016, if I remember. And at that time, Google had gotten caught doing this whole electronic sweep. It was December 2015. Google got caught at that point harvesting the data of minors in violation of not only their promises, but an agreement they had with the Federal Trade Commission that they would stop doing that. They had been doing it. They had gotten caught doing it. They had said, okay, no, this time we really mean it. We're going to stop harvesting kids' data. But they kept doing it, and they got caught again. Their answer again was to say, "Aw, shucks, would you look at that? We are so sorry. We're, you know, this time, honest engine, no crossies, we're going to quit. Like, we're not going to harvest kids' data anymore. So sorry about that," right? Well, in the news 2 days ago, MSN, Vox, open source, all sorts of media are reporting New Mexico is suing Google for doing it again, this time in violation of the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. So they're all these years later after, no, we're not going to do that anymore, they are still harvesting kids' data using their devices that they hand out to kids for free at schools. All, you know, because it's all for education. And of course, they treat this like it's some kind of benevolent thing they're doing. I'm sure they take a tax break for doing it. But the reality is none of that's why they're doing it. They're doing it because if they don't do that, they don't have access to your data and your kids' data. And they want it all.
What is data worth? I mean, what is Facebook? If you could put a price on my data for a year, what is that worth to a company like Google?
Oh, depending on who you are, millions, because it's not just you. They get to sweep it all up together along with your neighbor's data, their neighbor's data, your friend's data. They break this out into several different modules or models. So if you can imagine that they would be able, you become your data all by itself is of some value to them because they want to market, they want to market directly to you. They want to target directly to you. Excuse me. Okay, so to do that, they have to have some picture of what your data looks like, right? But more than just your data, it's your data and the data of other people that are similar enough to you so that now they've got this really, really accurate profile. So to give you just an idea of how much your data can be worth as an individual, and I talked about this, by the way, I do a podcast about this type of thing. It's called Enemy of the Surveillance State because I wanted to keep it subtle. Enemy of the Surveillance State, which can be found at Podbean, enemyofsurveillance.podbean.com, or anywhere else where your listeners grab their podcasts. I'm listed on all of the major services. And a couple of weeks ago, I dealt with this very question, like, okay, so big deal. They're listening to my phone calls. They're reading my texts. They're harvesting my browsing data. They know where I've been, who I've been with, what I was talking about, but I don't have anything to hide. So why should I care? Right? Like, big deal. It's not like I'm doing anything wrong. I have nothing to hide. So in that episode of the podcast, I told a story about a teenager in Minneapolis, just outside Minneapolis, Minnesota, back in, I think this was 2012, 13, somewhere in that neighborhood. Her father walks into the Target department store there, slaps some advertisements down on the counter and demands to speak to the manager. Now, Evan, you've shopped at Target once or twice in your life, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody has. And so if you've done that, when you're standing at the register, they ask if you want to use your red card. Always. It's like part of their script. They have to ask this question. And so red card started out as a credit card that would be used only in their stores and on their website, and they would knock 5% off your purchase every time you used it. But if you're like me, you're like, no thanks, I've already got enough plastic in my wallet, I'm good to go. So they thought, how can we get more people to do this?
Like you too, Mitch. I've never said yes to that. So
yeah, never
another,
ever.
We have another thing in common.
Yeah, I've got enough plastic in my wallet. Thanks anyway. So they turned it into a debit card. Get this. This is how, like, we have to make this work. So they turn it into a debit card that's tied. It ties your checking account directly to the debit card, and it can only be used in their stores and on their website. And they will still knock 5% off your purchase with no fee to you at all. So again, I ask, hey, cui bono? You know, who benefits? What's in it for you, right? Well, what's in it for them is data analysis, data mining and data analysis. How good is it? So back to the father. He slaps this information down on the desk and he says, you just sent this to my 16-year-old daughter. It's advertisements for baby food, baby formula, baby clothes, diapers, all baby stuff, right? She's 16 years old. She's still in high school. What are you trying to encourage kids to start having babies? The manager says, sir, I'll check into it. I'll get back to you. Give me a couple of days. Well, he doesn't have to wait a couple of days. The father calls him the very next day with his hat in his hand and apologizes. He says, I had a conversation with my daughter last night, and you figured out she was pregnant before I did.
Wow.
Based only on her purchases in their store and on their website. Now, extrapolate that out to a company like Google that has access, if you're using Google products, Google has access to everything you do in your life. They've got your phone, they've got your laptop, they've got your smart TV, they've got it all. They harvest every little thing, and now they're doing it with kids. And it's not like Google is above being dishonest. They've been caught 3 or 4 times now harvesting kids' data through these Chromebooks and the Google Apps for Education suite. Not only that, there was a big study back in December 2018 showing shock and awe, be surprised, Google was still and again manipulating search results despite promises that they would stop doing it. They did this during the Clinton campaign. If you were to Google things about Hillary Clinton, all smiley faces and golden stars and happy unicorns would pop up. Nothing about her email scandal unless you dug deeper. You had to actually go so far as to type out Hillary Clinton email, okay? And then it probably wouldn't be the first result. So they've done this over and over and over. And in fact, back in June of 2017, the European Union was threatening to level a $9 billion fine against Google for manipulating search results. So we give these devices to kids, right, at schools. They give these devices to kids. They say, use this. Okay, well, it's built to use Google for everything. It is a Google Chromebook. They designed this, right? So where are your kids going to do their searches? Google. everything's going to be Google. So everything they research for school, like you're researching global warming for a project. And it doesn't really matter where you fall on the political spectrum for this. We're all conservatives, but I think liberals ought to be concerned about this as well, because the data has to be real. The search result has to be honest. I need to see the most relevant, most popular searches, because that's what I'm looking for. But that is not what Google is delivering, because they have an agenda, and part of their agenda is to get filthy, stinking rich while changing the world to fit their model. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
And their model is?
Their model is just rabid liberalism, one worldism, globalism. The whole idea is that the powers that be, now of course they despise the powers that be in America right now when it comes to the White House, but they moved heaven and earth to get Hillary Clinton into the White House. That ought to tell us everything we need to know about their political worldview. Now, fine, have a political worldview and own a company, but don't use that company to dishonestly nudge your customers toward a liberal worldview.
We've got about 1 minute left. Go ahead and finish what you said, and then I'll ask you a question.
Well, just to put this into perspective, Google is worth somewhere in the neighborhood of $131 billion. How have they made $131 billion giving away their services? Because they give away their services, but their service is not their product. Your data is their product. Mm-hmm. And again, I talk about more and more of this on my podcast, Enemy of the Surveillance State, so I hope people will check it out.
What else can people, before we end this, what else can people do? Can they follow you on Twitter? Is there any books that you recommend reading?
So you mentioned Ed Snowden's book at the beginning of this, and that's called Permanent Record. I recommend everyone read Ed Snowden's book because, again, he doesn't see the world the same way we do, but on this topic, he sees the world exactly the way you and I do, and the way I believe everyone else should too. That the question is never, ever, ever, what do I have to hide? I'll add this to it. Snowden doesn't say this, but this is something that I said on an episode of my podcast. The question is never what do I have to hide, but what do I have that's worth protecting?
Mm-hmm. And just a caveat to that, when Mitch, you and I talked about this, there are a few cuss words. There is some, you know, indecent stuff discussed during that book, and we don't like that part of Ed Snowden's book, but we do recommend the parts about, you know, data and why privacy is so important.
Yeah, I would recommend the book as a whole, but I'm with you. I mean, his attitude, for instance, toward pornography is very, very like, I think this is almost an exact quote from the book. So what? Everybody looks at porn. Who cares? And well, that's not true. Everyone does not look at porn, Ed. Sorry, I disagree with you there. And even if they were, it's not who cares. It's a moral failure on the part of everybody who's doing that, and it does matter. But I'm able to sort of spit out that gristle and hang on to the rest of the meat that's in his book because it's very worth the read.
Well, Mitch, thank you so much for being part of this Berkshire podcast. For those that are on this conference call, we're going to end the recording, and then we're going to go on to our Q&A session. How can people contact you, Mitch, if they want to contact you?
They can contact me at enemyofsurveillance@protonmail.com. enemyofsurveillance@protonmail.com. Or, this is going to sound really, really weird, but, you know, find me on Facebook. I am on Facebook because while I'm spreading the message of slamming the door in the face of surveillance, I had to go where people are, and darn it, people are on Facebook. I don't plan to hang on to that account for any long time at all, but I am on Facebook as C. Mitchell Shaw. If they do a search for Enemy of the Surveillance State, they'll find my page that I built to promote my website, and they can backtrack to my account from there if that's easier.
All right. Thanks for being on the show, Mitch.
Thanks, Evan.